It's whatever the gift by grace is. It doesn't yet identify what the gift is. In verse 16, the gift is not as by one who sinned. For on the one hand, now this is odd, the judgment is of one transgression under condemnation. That's not odd. You can see that. But on the other hand, the gift is of many transgressions under justification. Now see, there, that's not intended to be parallel, and it's obvious as you look into it. It's not that the gift arises out of many transgressions, but in spite of many transgressions. It's a gift unto justification. It's a judgment unto condemnation. The judgment comes about as a result of transgression. Transgression, sin, judgment, condemnation. The other, it doesn't specify what it is as opposed to transgression. But then, and then you don't have judgment, you have gift. And then it's justification rather than condemnation. So you do have parallels that way. But again, there's unlikeness as well as likeness. Verse 17. For if by the transgression of the one, again not identified, death ruled through the one, by the sin of one, death ruled through the one. Death ruled from Adam until Moses. By the transgression of the one, even though it doesn't identify him by name yet, death ruled through the one. Death ruled through the one. Not death ruled through the many, but death ruled through the one. Much more, those receiving the overflow of grace and the gift of righteousness shall rule in life through the one, Jesus Christ. Verse 18, consequently, therefore, as by one transgression there came unto all men condemnation, thus also by one righteous deed there came unto all men justification of life. One transgression, condemnation to all men, not just Adam to Moses, but all those who descended from Adam by ordinary generation. So condemnation arises from one transgression. And then verse 19. For just as through the disobedience of the one man, the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of one, the many shall be made righteous. Here we get clearly, toward the end of the passage. It starts in verse 16, but only hints. It really begins in verse 17, to be specific, 18 and 19. You're talking about one person transgressing, sinning, and death ruling through that one person, that one transgression. And it makes it more specific in verse 18, condemnation. Condemnation and justification are legal terms. So here we're talking, finally, about guilt and about righteousness in the legal sense. Guilt. Adam and Eve became guilty of transgression. Adam and Eve became corrupt and depraved through their sin. That corruption and depravity and that death, spiritual and physical, passed down to their descendants. The real question is, what happened to the guilt? And in this passage, we discover that this guilt is imputed, is charged to Adam's descendants. That is, those, all of Adam's descendants, but to those who are in Christ, those who once were guilty are now declared righteous. a legal transaction. Righteousness is credited to them. Jeff.
So guilt is imputed, even though sin is not.
Okay. Guilt is imputed. Now let's see. In verse 13, sin is not charged to one's account when there is not law. This could be a statement of principle, of truth, or it could be a hypothetical objector throwing in an objection. Let's see if it works both ways, or either way, I mean. As a principle, sin is not charged to one's account when there is not law. In that sense, let's take sin both as guilt and sin as sinfulness, all right? Or if you wish, acts of sin. Let's take all three. Guilt, sinfulness, corruption, depravity. Acts of sin. Guilt. Guilt is not charged to one's account when there is not law. That's obvious. You can't be guilty. Guilt is a legal term if you don't have law that pronounces you guilty. What about sinfulness, depravity, corruption? Corruption is not charged to one's account when there is not law. Corruption is not charged to one's account. The charging to one's account suggests the legal context rather than a moral recognition. Now, as far as acts of sin, you could put that in, try it. Sinful acts are not charged to one's account when there is not law. You commit a sinful act, but there's no law that says that act is sinful, then it's not charged to your account. You could do it that way. Or if there just isn't any law at all, then you're not charged with committing a sinful act if there's no law. You could handle it that way. If it's a hypothetical objector, and he says sin is not charged to one's account when there is not law, then verse 14, you have to proceed with Paul's argument, but death ruled from Adam until Moses. In which case, this would be a rejoinder to the hypothetical objector. And then Paul is saying, aha, but sin was charged. Now let's sort that out. Guilt was charged. Legal context, to one's account, from Adam until Moses. That is, they were guilty. On what ground were they guilty? They were not guilty because they transgressed the commandment given to Adam. That was no longer in effect. That was no longer to them. That was not addressed to their obedience. What about guilt? They were guilty of what? Guilty of transgressing the law of God written on the heart. You could say that. They were guilty in that sense. Legal guilt for committing acts of sin, the law in view is the law written on the heart. You could do that. But there, you'd have a hard time showing that the penalty for that would be death. See, now there's your problem. Whereas it's very clear that when Adam transgressed, the penalty promised was death. That's very clear. So Adam incurred guilt. Guilt was charged to his account. And the question is Paul then saying, death ruled from Adam until Moses? That shows that people from Adam until Moses were guilty. And guilty in the sense that Adam's guilt was visited upon them. Adam's guilt came upon them. And as the passage develops, you can see that you're talking about one who sinned and the many were condemned. And one transgressed and death ruled through the one. And one transgression, condemnation came. It becomes stronger and stronger as you go. the disobedience of one, the many were made sinners. And if you understand that, many were made sinners in the sense of 2 Corinthians 5:21, he hath made him to be sin for us who knew no sin. Then we're talking about guilt. The guilt of sin. And the guilt was imputed to Adam's descendants. And they died. They were guilty as well as corrupt. But guilt hung over them, condemnation, and still does. Comments? Questions? Ray.
Just as a dumb reaction, I wonder why there would be an imputation of sin to Adam's descendants only to impute sin to his son. It almost seems as though, again, this is just a gut reaction, I have a model car, and I break it just so that I can remake it. I'm wondering if there's not a sense of which corruption that the imputation is based upon the corruption, and that's assumed in the passage. Because I can understand how we're corrupt and perverted. I can understand that very clearly. Especially if we go to Lucy,
right.
I can understand that.
Right.
But it's this imputation aspect. And that kind of leads me to the realistic.
Mm-hmm. The realistic theory of imputation, yeah. But not, you wouldn't have to lead to that exclusively. You wouldn't have to lead out to that exclusively, even with a tradition view. Bart?
Just a question. If we go back into Genesis and look at Noah as an example again.
Yes.
There's a statement in particular made about Noah that I'm trying to reconcile with this model.
Right.
In Genesis 6:9, this would be kind of Noah. I mean, Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time,
right.
And he walked with God. Well, the idea of having the characteristics of blamelessness, in fact, the way he's brought out as being something unique, okay, among men of his time, one would have to assume that blame was associated with others and not with him. And again, this concept of righteousness, if we look at man as all fallen, all right, and having lost original righteousness, there's this aspect of righteousness that's associated with Noah that, you know, I'm trying to understand how we can take a passage like that and then fit it into the context of the way we're viewing Romans. If there is no law, in a force here, okay, then where does the blame come from, so to speak, for the rest of the generation? If it is imputation of guilt, then why wouldn't the same imputation of guilt apply to Noah? Why would he be singled out differently?
I don't see how he could be singled out differently.
Right, I don't either.
Yeah.
So then we're probably not talking about imputation with regard to his righteousness and his blamelessness among men. And so if it's not imputed guilt that he received from his nature, the human nature through Adam, okay, then there's something unusual about this. And again, this is he's used as an example in Hebrews in the Hall of Faith there, if you will. And also there's some additional claims made about him in Peter.
Yeah.
Okay, so he certainly stands out as an example.
Absolutely.
And faith may play a role in here somewhere to make him a little bit unique. But just looking at those terms, the NIV's rendering, the idea of being righteous and blameless, sitting in this environment where there is no law, so there wouldn't be a way of comparing for individual acts of sin. I'm wondering if there isn't. I agree with our analysis to extend of the Romans passage. If there isn't some, in some sense, okay, law operating. Okay, in this sphere.
In Noah's time.
Yeah, in Noah's time. And I have another reason for saying that, in the sense that one would expect sort of a passing down of tradition. I mean, Adam and Eve walked with God.
Yes, yes.
They would have known the ways of God and could have transmitted these ideas to their children and to their children's children.
Yeah.
And in 2 Peter, Noah is also documented or noted as being a preacher of righteousness.
Yes.
And so if he was, what was he proclaiming then? All right. If there wasn't anything for him to proclaim.
Good question.
So there seems to be, to some extent, some sort of knowledge of God or some sort of understanding of righteousness that was being transmitted from generation to generation from Adam down through to Moses. So it doesn't seem that they're without, without any sense of right and wrong, without any, that type of situation.
Ray's anxious to say what he says, otherwise I'll make a rejoinder. Go ahead.
It just occurred to me that it's possible the reason why he brings up law is he's maybe thinking of the Jews who thought, well, we've got the law of Moses, but he said earlier in the book that all people are consigned under sin. I just lost my thought.
That's bad, isn't it? Yeah. I do that for myself.
What was the last thing you said about the transmission of some idea?
Oh, well, yeah, there's some law being passed on. Creature of righteousness.
It'll come back to you. Bart, one interesting thing about this is what you said about Noah. You have to ask the question about Old Testament salvation. Was there a different way of salvation for Noah? Or was faith necessary for him? You mentioned, he's mentioned as a hero of faith. And that is faith in order to be in right relationship to God. And was the new birth necessary for him? That is, was he in exactly the same position spiritually and morally as the people at Jesus' day, Nicodemus, for example? Or did spiritual death and moral depravity begin just when Jesus came? Did it start then? Or does that go all the way back to the fall? In other words, if Noah was spiritually dead and morally depraved, something had to happen to him, presumably in relation to faith, and presumably that faith had to be exercised in relation to whatever revelation had been given to him up to that point, which was saving revelation. In other words, whatever was saving revelation. That is, if God speaks a word of saving revelation to Noah and Noah receives it by faith, then presumably that does something to him. So that you could, I suspect, in light of Hebrews 11, you could say something in regard to his justification. You could say something then as far as a right standing before God for Noah, as well as an uprightness of character, an integrity of his character and of his lifestyle in the world in which he lived. Now, if you've got from Adam down, two basic lines going there. If you've got a line, a godly line proceeding from Adam, and an ungodly line proceeding from Adam, and if the godly line are the people who are the heroes of faith, the ones who are the fathers, if those are godly people in the, say, the Genesis 5 and Genesis 11 genealogies, if they're godly people that we're talking about, then presumably if they had to be born again and if they had to have a right standing before God through faith, then I think we can talk about imputation of righteousness as well as uprightness of lifestyle and character. I think we can talk about that in response to the saving revelation they had received up to that time, which admittedly is a movable idea, because more and more revelation is added as you go along. At first, you have very little. I mean, the amount of explicit revelation concerning the coming Redeemer is admittedly very small as far as data. But that grows as you go along. And presumably, those people would be responsible to believe in whatever revelation had been given up to that point, including Noah. So if you look at Genesis 6 and mention all the things you mentioned, why did Noah find favor? How does it mean when it says Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time? How does it mean he walked with God? You have to sort all that out. How does it mean he was a preacher of righteousness? You have to sort all that out and at least ask the question, because, see, it's not a New Testament concept, you must be born again. I mean, that's mentioned in the Old Testament, looking forward to the future, say in Jeremiah 31. And Nicodemus was held responsible for that. Are you a master in Israel and don't know about these things? So that necessity began at the fall. That would apply to Noah as well, as and the other heroes of faith. They needed to be born again. They couldn't do it, that is, be righteous on their own. That was impossible for them, as it is for us. So I think all those factors have to be plugged in here in terms of recognizing their natural condition and their need. And unless you posit two ways of salvation, then, you know, then you... Yeah, okay.
So then your point. That's a good point. You bring in the factor of faith and their relationship, individual relationships with God need to be superimposed on our model here.
Yeah.
So we're looking at specific individuals in the context.
Precisely. Precisely. Now, I've gone much too long, but you see what happened. We just got carried away here. And as a result, look at the time. Now, we're supposed to end at 10 of, but we didn't take a break, so we should end at 20 of, right? Isn't that right? Nope. Don't I get any response? Yes? Yes?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that leaves us about 8 minutes. Jeff.
So doesn't that, you know, back to the same discussion, doesn't that then make it, this whatever revelation had already been revealed, in a sense, does that then become the law?
It what certainly has the force of law as far as what you are obligated to believe.
But it doesn't, again, there's no statement as far as carried forward as far as what the judgment of it.
No.
So what the penalty is.
No.
And so we still don't have, you know, the guilt, the condemnation there.
Well, but the question, Jeff, is, does another pronouncement need to be made from Adam until Moses, if that guilt is visited upon Moses' descendants? Does another pronouncement have to be made? That's the question here. And the way Paul develops the passage, it sounds like there is no necessity of a further revelation concerning sin and consequent death. That is, these people are born into this life from Adam to Moses, spiritually dead and physically dying, whether they know it or not.
So then you would say in verse 13, sin is not charged to one's account when there is no law. Is it? Well, of course it is.
Exactly. Sin is charged to one's account when there is law, and there was law. There was law.
And that sin is still charged.
Pardon?
And that sin is still charged even though there is no law.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Sin is still charged. It's not charged in the sense that death is visited because individuals transgress
right.
The law of God written in the heart. It's not charged that way. Right. Okay. But it is charged. And death is quite obvious. People died. Death ruled during that period. It ruled. Well, this is quite an amazing passage, and we've only just scratched the surface of it, even with your previous reading. Questions for a few minutes on these theories of imputation. There's presented fairly straightforwardly. Pelagian, Arminian, mediate imputation, natural headship, federal headship. And you've read this material, so it's not necessary for me to go through it carefully. I would like to suggest one thing, however. And that is this. If you're torn, or if you're nudged, torn between these two views, natural headship and federal headship, or you're nudged in one direction as opposed to another, consider this. Is it possible to hold both? that all human beings were actually present in Adam in terms that they were there as far as their human nature. The whole human nature was there in Adam. They were really there. And at the same time, is it possible to stress that just as Christ is our representative in regard to justification, Adam was our representative in regard to condemnation. So that both things could be said, both the realistic and the representative view, both the natural headship and the federal headship theories. Think about that as a possibility. Right. Yes. Since, by the way, the Arminian theory, unfortunately named, because Jacobus Arminius would have rejected it as it stands. But the Arminian theory, since it's held by Wesleyan Arminians, since it was held by the Wesley brothers, since it was held by Pope, since it was held by Wiley and Miley, since it was held by these various fine, godly men, I would not begin to suggest that the Arminian theory is heretical. Yes. Yes. The theory, in one sec, the theory of mediate imputation has some internal problems, rather bristling problems, that have to be smoothed out. We have to work with that if one is of a mind to adopt it. Jenny. C. Yes. Well, that's what this view holds. I do not think that God's justice requires that. No. Not everybody hears the gospel. And down through the ages, a lot of people have never heard the gospel.
Right, but you say that because they've never heard the gospel, does that automatically mean that they all end up in hell?
Oh, well, that's the way this is set up. I mean, this is stated that way. In other words, it's through the gospel. I'm suggesting that this is set up in that way. This does not touch the question of whether any sinner could be delivered from his sinfulness apart from the gospel. It doesn't touch that issue. It just says, as far as this issue is concerned, through the gospel, God's justice requires this. In other words, God's justice requires that everybody hear the gospel. See, because in this view, it's through the gospel that people are delivered. So this doesn't touch the other issue. That's exactly. Exactly. No. Wesley would have rejected that very strongly. Yeah. Last question? Comment? Yes.
And died after Christ was.
He could have been saved as readily as someone who lived as a pious, devout Jew before Christ was born. He could have been saved as readily. Because those people before Christ were born, if they were saved by looking forward to the Messiah. And if a person, if a Jew living in 70 AD had not heard the gospel, that Christ had come and that Christ was the Messiah, that person could be saved on the same ground as the person who lived before Christ could be saved.
It's funny the different possibilities that we came up with. That if a person was born again 5 BC and yet he lived
yes.
until after Christ was crucified, if he didn't hear about Jesus, somehow he lost his born againness. You know, it sort of was canceled out because he didn't hear about Jesus.
I don't think we said that,
well,
did we?
No, the idea. We nudged about it. I mean, we never said
that. Didn't say that, no. I would have rejected that if that had come up. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll look for you Thursday. Thursday is the big day.
Open notebook, I hear.
Where did you hear that?
Same word here. Open
notebook. Interrelation. Very good. I think you can assume that, yeah.
All right, the one question will throw, show up.
Throw up. No, no.
The one question will show up on all three lists. Two of the questions will show up on two lists, and the rest of them will show up on one list.
That doesn't mean 2, 3, and 4 will be on two lists. It means 2 and 3 could be together, 3 and 4 could be together, 4 and 2 could be together.
No, you have three lists. Those could show up on any two of the three lists.
Together. So all three have to be together.
No, for instance, 2 could show up on 1 and 3. 3 could show up in 1 and 2. 4 could show up in 2 and 3. But, see, Jenny is getting some additional information out of this by process of elimination. That's very clever. You do this in Clue. Have you ever played the game Clue? You do that. That's a fun game. You do a lot of that process of elimination.
Do you want me to take that quiz?
Sure. Jeff, you could. It depends how quickly you take it. But I mean, you could put it through the office door. There's, you know, there's a slot there, a mail slot in the office door. Put it right through there. Just put it back in the envelope, throw it right through the door. Okay?
Okay. Should I put your name on it or anything? Or
yeah, that'd be good.
If I can retain all of this wealth of information.
Yeah, well, that's tough. That's tough. Yeah, but think of this part. I'm a professor. Say, know the material. Now think of that. I mean, that.
I certainly would know the detail.
That chills me to the bone, a statement like that. I mean, especially when you have this amount of material. That destroys me.
This is really clarifying in my mind a lot of issues that I've been floating around
intended to do this.
For a long time.
Good.
So I'm looking forward to the second half.
Great.
If I survive Thursday.
What?
I said I'm looking forward to the second half if I survive
Thursday. Oh, if you survive Thursday, yes. Right. Yeah. Very good.
I know that one of the general freaks. I got terrible math.
Two, three, and four, yes, that's it.
want to ask you a different way. If I were to, based upon what you said, say I did not want to answer 15 and 16, but I knew all of the others.
15 and 16.
Yes, for example.
Yeah.
I would say, well, I can't answer those, and I were to pick any other list that did not have those two on it. In other words, there would be...
It would confine you to one list, then.
Yeah, it would confine me to one list.
Yeah.
But 16 would be on one, or maybe 15 and 16 might be on one, but 15 would be on one, possibly, and 16 on another.
That's right. That's right.
As long as I knew the last.
Oh, you're right. Now, 15 and 16 could be on one,
right?
And then you'd have two lists to choose from. Yeah.
If 15
and
16 are on the same
clock,
that's a gamble.
Of course it is, but they're trying to figure something out.
When you said That's why. It's hard to conceive a miracle. Yeah, it is.
Make one up.
Yeah. Okay. But the other two are on the corner of
the
game. Yeah.
I know. I know. Thank you. The question is a little lost. I know we debated last quarter about that the Jew, the pious Jew. But now, let's bring up now. I mean, okay. No one is saved apart from the gospel, right? I mean, everybody comes to the cross and they don't come at all. Whether they hear the gospel.
No one came apart from the full revelation of the gospel. Now, what was revealed to them as far as saving truth at various stages in the history of redemption was also gospel.
Right.
So Noah believed the gospel. Isaiah believed the gospel.
Right.
And again, it's not just a question of how he understood it, it's a question of what was revealed to him. What was revealed to him in terms of what had been given in Revelation. That had to be understood to some extent, not exhaustively, but to some extent, and had to be received by faith.
Okay, I understand that. Okay, but that means like today, someone, let's say, in the islands of the South Pacific. Okay,
right.
Are we saying that that's the same standard that Noah had? You know, let's say the gospel never reaches a certain island that has several thousand people on there. I mean, what's the criteria now? I mean, are we saying? I mean, I know we're not saying that God makes exceptions.
Are you talking about a person on a South Sea island that has had some exposure to Christian truth or biblical truth?
Well, let's say he has, and let's say this is, you know,
has not.
Okay.
Doesn't even know the Bible or Christ or anything.
Right. Because if he has exposure, then he's culpable, really.
Yeah.
There. Let's say he hasn't. Because, my upbringing is, you can...
We haven't addressed that issue.
Yeah, but...
We haven't addressed that issue.
But basically, that's my question. I realize that.
Oh, I see.
I want to make sure I put the invitation together.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I just want to make sure that God doesn't make any exceptions here.
Well, I thought you were getting back to the question of a godly, pious Jew who did not know the gospel. I thought you were getting to that one.
Well, I took it one step further than that.
Yeah.
So you're talking about a Gentile.
Yeah.
Who has had no contact with the God, the scripture, or the truth of scripture.
Yeah. It's a real question. What about the native somewhere?
That's a different ballgame altogether. I'd like to keep those distinct.
Yes, they have to be distinct.
Okay.
But we're not saying that a pious Jew today, he's never heard the gospel, although he believes in the Torah, the teachings of the Messianic promises, who's never heard the gospel can be redeemed.
I wouldn't know of anyone. Such one.
Yeah, it can't be. It's impossible.
But as far as somebody in Tibet,
okay,
or someone in the northern part of China in some of those little villages,
sure,
where hardly anybody has ever been,
right,
and has never had a missionary or a gospel witness or anything, the question then is the person culpable for general revelation? Paul says yes.
I'd be awful surprised if that were the case.
Does that person have the law of God written on the heart? Yes. Does conscience pronounce upon their deeds, their actions, their thoughts, their desires? Yes. No. Yes. No. Answer yes. So the question is there enough there, both an internal and external general revelation, to render them culpable? Guilty before God, and sufficient ground for their judgment on the day of judgment? Paul says, yes, there is. The other question is there enough there for their salvation?
That's the other side.
The other side,
yes,
the flip
right
side.
Which needs to be balanced, yes.
Yeah. Is there a way that they can be saved through that general, external, internal, general revelation? If it is not, say, let's introduce an extraneous factor. If it's not their fault that they've never heard the gospel.
Okay, understood.
Introduce that factor.
Yes, that's fair enough.
So if they're blameless as far as the hearing of the gospel is concerned, and they can't reject it because they've never been exposed to it.
Okay.
So then the question is, can they be saved through general revelation alone, apart from the gospel? It's easy here to be dogmatic and to say, no, they can't be. Because it's only through not just Christ's work, but Christ's work as proclaimed in the gospel and received by faith that people are saved. It's easy to be dogmatic and say that. The other way is can Christ's work be applied to those who have never heard the gospel? And you can use a test case outside of the controverted issue. You can ask, what about people severely retarded? Okay. Or infants dying in infancy? They're saved apart from ever hearing the gospel. Okay? If they are saved.
Okay, that's an if.
I'll put the big if in. Okay. If they're saved, well, if anybody is saved in those two categories,
right,
they're saved apart from the hearing of the gospel.
That would be correct, if they are, yes. That's
so then you have a choice to make. Either they're all lost by virtue of their severe retardedness or by virtue of the fact that they die as infants. Even if they're killed, put to death, like in Herod's time.
Yes, understood.
And you could say, well, they can't hear the gospel, therefore they can't be saved, therefore they're lost, period. Can't be saved. Most Christians in the history of Christian doctrine have not been willing to take that position.
That they're totally lost?
That you have to hear the gospel in order to be saved.
But most Christians are not willing to take that.
They have not been willing to take that position. And those are the two test cases.
So that there is a factor built in that is, we don't want to say exception, do we?
Well, see, if you use those as test cases, then obviously the next question is, well, what about those who, through no fault of their own, have never heard the gospel? Especially when you think back in century after century after century, in lands to which the gospel never came, no witness.
Right.
What about those people? And if you say, if they are saved, they can't be saved by another way of salvation. They have to be saved through Christ and his atoning work.
Right.
But see, to say that is not to say, it's not saying the same thing as saying the gospel has to get to them and they have to receive it by faith.
It's not like their ears have hearing. their ears didn't have to hear the five letter word Jesus.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, still up in the heavenlies, his atonement is applied
towards
them.
On what grounds, though?
We're back to the faith for their belief in God relative to whatever they know.
The way that they know.
Okay. We're back to Noah, who had no. In theory, okay, he didn't have any of Genesis. He didn't have, okay, he had no writings, per se, that we're told of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so we're back to Noah's in the same ball game as the guy that's in Ethiopia somewhere.
I don't know that that's the case. If he had oral revelation, it wouldn't have had to have been written.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but
if he had oral revelation.
But the only oral revelation to Noah that is recorded is after he's already been told.
But that's dangerous to say the only that has been recorded, because how many chapters do you have that are devoted to that whole section of history up to Abraham? What, 10 chapters or something like that?
That's true.
And look at all those people during that time. It's dangerous to say that because it says he walked with God, Noah. See, when we read that about Enoch, he was a godly man. He walked with pleased God. Well, now, you can't please God just by happenstance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay? By accident.
Right.
That is, you may do that once in a thousand, but do that as a lifestyle. You've got to know what pleases him. So I think we have to posit some oral revelation, or even some written revelation, which they wrote down but which wasn't included in Scripture, or perhaps formed some background for the books of...
But is it not the same principle of faith relative to what has been revealed?
Absolutely. It has to be.
So the Ethiopian, or whatever, the guy in China, what has been revealed to him, what's on his heart, general revelation, creation...
Conscience.
His conscience, and so then he must apply all that information, all that intake to God, glorification of God, and his faith in that there is a God.
So suppose he does not respond in what I would call general faith. That is, respond to general revelation with general faith. Suppose he doesn't respond that way.
See, faith looks forward to something in the future. I have faith in what God has promised. I have faith in what God has said, okay, that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So what does he have to look forward to? He knows of nothing.
Well, that's
only he knows is what it has been.
Hope is certainly one aspect of faith. Hope is certainly faith looking to the future, but faith looking to the past is simply believing what God has said. Even
okay.
If you weren't there.
That's true.
For instance, at creation.
Right.
You weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
But believing what he
so
said.
So that's that aspect of faith,
yeah,
that that guy
right.
in China or whatever
right.
should be applying.
Yes.
Hmm.
And not only that, but you see, now, it's one thing to say hypothetically he could be saved. It's another thing, now you bring up an important point. But actually, how does he respond to the general revelation that he has?
Mm-hmm.
If he responds by suppressing it and rejecting it, then you ask, well, can he say if he responds in that fashion? Paul was going to suggest no.
But if he responds in faith, then
okay.
his heart, he sincerely wants to love this God. He doesn't know what his name is. He calls him Abba. This God's name is Abba because that's what he's told.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, but Abba wants you to love people
mm-hmm.
and do what's right. And he wants to hear God and do what's right. And if his heart bends and kneels to the creator of the universe,
yes.
he would think that he would be saved.
The problem there is that although ontologically in existence, we can talk about the reality of God and his characteristics. And whether I believe in him or don't believe in him doesn't change anything. And we can talk about the atoning work of Christ, whether I believe in it or not, it changes anything.
Mm-hmm.
Ontologically, it's there. And I can say, well, epistemologically, as far as knowledge is concerned,
for the severely retarded person, for the infant, if any of those people are saved, then it's not epistemologically that they come into contact with the ontological reality.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we don't have to put that between the ontological reality and the person. That is knowing, understanding to a certain degree, but and responding in faith. But at the same time, you have to ask, and this is critical, if the person in Tibet is saved apart from a faith response, purely on the basis of the reality of Christ's atoning work, even though he's not epistemologically in contact with that, because he doesn't know about it. If he's saved on that ground, you still have to ask, is there any condition for salvation on his part?
You save on that ground, you still keep all the evangelists home. Leave
them alone. That's where the impact of missions comes in. Because you know, you read the pamphlet that says 50,000 Chinese die daily without Christ. Well, according to what we've been talking about, maybe not 50,000 do die without Christ. And if the person in China, in remote mountains, never heard the gospel, let's not make him culpable. Let's just kind of leave him the way he is. Because if he can make it with a chance of faith from his own heart in the general revelation, let's save the $200,000 a year sending missionaries out there. Let's go to a place where the work is very established.
Yeah, but that man you're talking about in China is just as responsible, no matter how much information he has. You know what I mean? Like, if he only has general revelation, he's got to be responsible to that thoroughly, you know,
mm-hmm.
to meet
well,
God's standard with that.
Though,
so if you give him then the gospel of Christ, that one man is either going to respond to the little bit or the big amount
mm-hmm.
the same way.
What is the response to that?
Well, that is a question you have to consider. Can you globalize that
mm-hmm.
and say that the response of the natural man to either special revelation or general revelation is going to be similar? That he's going to reject it. This is a statement of facticity.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is, then what's it going to take to break through that opposition?
The Spirit of God, just like it came from all here in the United States.
Exactly so. Precisely so. It's going to take the Spirit of God to break through the opposition.
So we know not that whether all these people that die every day in the United States, and certainly in the states they occur, but in other countries perhaps not, but we have no idea what their eternal condition is. But then you're hard pressed. What about the Gentiles? You have to consider the Gentiles of old. So they weren't reading, you know, what the Old Testament was saying. They're just out there in the middle of nowhere, and presumably they're not being saved.
Well,
God's not walking with them.
Well, but Cornelius, the Gentile, was a God-fearer. And he was a God-fearer.
The problem there then is whether Cornelius was a proselyte. That's the question. Whether he was a proselyte or not.
Right.
But he had a scroll of Isaiah. He had grown up to the country. So if he was a proselyte, you can't categorize him as a fair Gentile.
Mm-hmm.
As Paul said in Athens, we will hear you again on this matter.
Yeah.
I've been so ingrained that the gospel really means, you know, it's kind of hard to shake sometimes. Or I'm fighting between what I've been taught and what I'm thinking, you know.
Because you're back to the definition of what the gospel is.
Yeah, like I can see that the conflict, that just, I haven't gotten the total picture, you know, it's just kind of a, that there's possibilities beyond what I've been really taught.
See, I don't personally have a lot of trouble with God allowing an infant or a retarded person to go to hell. Because many times in the Old Testament, children, all kinds of people were punished because of something that their father did. Okay? Earth just opened up and swallowed their whole family. Well, that child, you know, quote, didn't deserve to die. Okay? But yet God killed the child.
And also death is different than hell. If the definition of hell is eternal conscious punishment, torture, I mean, that's different
than
death. I mean, if I shoot you today, so you're done and dead, maybe God will have a volcano come and wipe you out.
True.
A little child, that could be mercy, actually. If the parents will say a little child had both parents wiped out in war, the child would be an orphan and might go through living hell on earth. The fact that the child was wiped out might be mercy.
That's a good point.
I would have a problem with what he said, simply for the fact that I know God's righteous in his character. So just because of God's character is, whatever the decision was, I would have no problem because God can only do what's right. So there I wouldn't have any problem. But I have to be careful to make sure it's what the Bible teaches, not what my emotions dictate or my opinion dictate. That's what I'm saying is, past the emotional aspect, what does the Scriptures clearly teach? So that's what I need to believe, that's what I need to teach. So that's... And it's hard because, you know, when you think of children, it's so emotional, you know.
Sure.
Especially when you see children suffer. There's nothing worse than to see a child suffer. And to think of eternal suffering, you know, just in your emotions, you reject that with as much, but yet, you know, God cannot do anything except what's right, so. Anyway, I appreciate that, Will.
I'll tell people, Will. Thanks for your sharing, too.
Thank you.
It's good to have an interaction like that.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks again for the question, too. I appreciate that.
All right.
This happens to be one of the biggest issues that has caused me so much turmoil in the past couple of years. And that's why I signed up to talk to you in the end of January. My subject is the concept of hell.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a little different than like the issue we were talking about, which I went up with a liberation.
Thank you.
I looked at some of it. Very interesting.
Think through some of these issues that's happening deeply all around and all the different causes. And, well, actually, there have been some solutions that's a lot better about the issues that we're talking about.
You're
a
liberal?
Yeah.
Wow.
In a decade?
Some of it we might just have to resolve, but
thank you.
We're not going to know.
Thanks.
We don't necessarily know.
Yeah, but then
that's not for us to know.
Yeah, but I think that there's a lot of things that we can know from looking at Scripture.
I agree with you. All I'm saying is that the possibility of us not knowing is very real. And perhaps protective. Okay. Let's just say hypothetically that children do go to hell. For God to come out and say that, okay, in the Bible, for most of us, that would be rather traumatic. That would be very difficult for us to handle these little, quote, innocent children that have done nothing wrong, all those things, being punished. And so that would be very difficult for